I don't have a gavel, so we're going to officially call the meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 20th. We're going to get started right away because we have a very long agenda that we're going to try to quickly get through. So, Representative Kiefer, it's my understanding that we don't technically have your bill in our possession because it didn't get processed fast enough.
Oh, didn't know that.
So we did not learn that until just now. And so, Representative Kiefer, I want to make sure that your bill actually passes and gets to the floor. So right now I don't have a committee planned for tomorrow, but if members don't...
Now it did.
It just got to us, officially.
Wow. Who said government's not efficient?
Who says it's not? They just sent us an email saying that we just got it. All right.
Thank you.
All right. So, Representative Kiefer, I will move, unless someone else wants to move, that House File 142 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. It's my understanding that it doesn't have a fiscal note.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
It does have a fiscal note, so you have to go to Ways and Means.
Okay, the Department of Corrections said that they would absorb the potential cost, and we've heard this bill before in public safety.
Okay, so Representative Kiefer, I'm told that if they have agreed to absorb the cost, that it can go to the floor. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm being told. And if someone else thinks it needs to go to the General Register, do I have your agreement that we'll just move it, or I mean we'll move it back to
right.
Ways and Means?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. So with that, Representative Kiefer, please briefly tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 142, this is its second session. It's had broad bipartisan support. I think Rep. Johnson was on the bill last year with us on the Public Safety Committee. This is just to enhance the penalties for repeat fifth-degree sex offenders. So basically that's the petty crimes, but they are typically done at a younger age, and prosecutors are asking for a stronger tool in the toolbox to stop this behavior before it becomes a bigger problem down the road.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. The chair renews her motion that House File 142 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Kiefer.
There you go. That's how you do it,
Billy. Representative Moline. The chair moves that House File 865 be recommended. Nope, wrong one. House File 392 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. It's my understanding there's an author's amendment. Do we have a copy of that yet? There's two author's amendments. Do we have all of those? So you all have one in your possession, and the second one is being passed out. So, Representative Moline, why don't you tell us about, are these two amendments your amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have two amendments. One is the DE4, and the second one that's being passed out, I'm not sure the number on.
It's an A5. So, you're on the committee. So, Representative Moline moves the DE4 to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And then A5, is that correct, Representative Moline?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And does everyone have that amendment
now?
Okay, we'll wait until everyone has it. Does everyone have the A5 amendment? Anyone not have it? All right. Representative Moline moves the A5 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Moline, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing House File 392 as amended. And I do have a number of testifiers here today, and I know that we have a big agenda, so I won't take too much time. But the First Amendment, the DE4, the Delete Everything Amendment that was just added onto the bill, it sort of changes our original strategy, I guess, the way that the bill went, which was to members in 1986, felony proceedings for 16 and 17-year-olds became open to the public. The original bill was going to close those proceedings except for in extended juvenile jurisdiction and adult certification cases. And the idea behind that was because of the great collateral consequences that are suffered by juveniles as a result of these court proceedings. This is, of course, before they are adjudicated or convicted. It's simply that they've been arrested for a felony. That arrest can result in a dismissal. It could result in a lesser offense. And so this was designed to close those proceedings to protect against some of the collateral consequences that our juveniles are facing, not being able to get into college, not being able to get employment. It's a good bipartisan bill. The county attorneys and the newspaper association, frankly, had some issues with the hearings being closed, so we came up with a compromise, which was the DE4 amendment that was just added to the bill. And that keeps the proceedings open for the 16 and 17-year-olds who are charged with a felony, even if it's just a strict juvenile case, not only EJJ and adult certifications, but all proceedings for 16 and 17-year-olds. And instead gets at, I guess, what the real problem is, having to do with data mining and having to do with the collateral consequences that result from juveniles with arrest or criminal records. And so the compromise is to allow the judge to keep the name of the juvenile off of the electronic public record, except in the cases where the prosecutor has filed a motion for adult certification, the prosecutor has designated or requested that the proceeding be designated EJJ prosecution, or the juvenile has been adjudicated delinquent of a crime of violence as defined in section 624.712. And so that's what I guess would be considered the most serious or egregious offenses. Those juveniles' names would still be available on the electronic public record. And then the second amendment that we just added is the...
Is there a problem with the second amendment?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Was it the A5 that we added on?
Yes. Why don't we do the rest of your testimony, and if there's a problem with the amendment, you guys can figure out what that is while the testimony is going on, and we can try to fix it.
Okay, Madam Chair, we'll go to the rest of the testimony. Thanks.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Mark Hosley, Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I really don't have anything to add to Representative Moline's comments about where the bill has come from here and the purposes of it. There are some other folks that have more experience working with this kid than me that would like to speak to it. I just would note that these records, even the ones that the judge chooses not to have appear the name of the juvenile appear electronically on public access. All those records, including the juvenile's name, are still available for law enforcement background checks, for working in schools, for Department of Human Services background checks, and all those other areas where we have provisions to allow extra access to juvenile records. I also just want to say quickly all the groups that support this change include the Minnesota Corrections Association, my organization, the Council on Crime and Justice, the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, Association of Community Probation Officers and the Juvenile Detention Association. So it's just a lot of community support for changing this problem and addressing the issue of kids being stuck with these public records and holding them back indefinitely. Thank you.
Further testifiers, Representative Moline?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Go ahead. Please be mindful that we have a lengthy agenda today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to be here today. My name is Andrea Emery, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Corrections Association, where we represent corrections throughout the entire state of Minnesota within facilities and within the community. Today, I'm just pleading for an opportunity to our youth to have greater access for personal and social growth. I am in support of House File 392. Our current law was enacted in 1986 and opened up to all children aged 16 and 17 who are charged with a felony level offense to the public. At that time, there wasn't such a thing as the average American sitting at their home in their rocking chair with the internet and being able to do searches. Right now, anybody sitting from the comfort of their own home can do a search on adolescents charged with these types of crimes and can dig up all of their information, which would include what they were charged with, court conditions that are filed for the interim, and every single condition that the court does order. Again, this is just based on what they were charged with. So a child may end up coming in and pleading to a misdemeanor offense, but because it arose out of that felony, when they do those background checks, that's the first thing that's going to show up is the fact that they were charged with that felony offense. And so on any given weekly basis, me as a juvenile probation officer, I come with 14 years of experience now. I have kids coming to me all the time, constantly. They're in tears. Their parents are coming with them. They're in tears because they've been hired at places as simple as Subway, McDonald's, Walmart. We're talking our entry-level type positions, and they're getting hired at these places. And then when the criminal background check comes back, because the manager may have been doing a public search just from their home phone or from their home computer, they've been let go of their employment. And so if we are not allowing our kids to get the most basic type of employment and housing, however will they move forward? These kids are also not allowed to get even Section 8 housing or public type housing, and simply because when they pull up that charge, it's the felony level offense that shows up. Again, it's with a records check from the home computer. At 18, they're prohibited from access from public housing. They're unable to access student loans. And then oftentimes they're ending up staying with peers, anybody who's willing to take them in, therefore recreating that cycle. And this is not certainly about any kind of secrecy. It's about privacy for our youth. Our proposal still protects all of the victims' rights. Of course, they would continue to have access. And as Mr. Hazy well put it, all the people who still have access to the juvenile records, whether it would be police, probation, or if they're applying for different types of jobs, all of that would still be available to them. We're just simply looking at the public access to these records. The point of this law was originally to promote public safety, and currently it is not serving that purpose because kids are continuing then to come into the system if they're not able to access their most basic employment and housing. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Next testifier is Representative Moline. Why don't you come up to the table if there's more? Come up to the table so that we're ready, so that we don't spend a lot of time transitioning. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Go ahead and please try not to repeat any testimony that we've already had.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bruce Hagstrom. I'm a probation officer in Chisago County. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. And I'm here to speak about the A5 amendment that was just passed out to be A4.
So currently the A5, members, this is what I've learned. The A5 amendment was adopted, but the A4 amendment has better language that does the same thing.
Exactly.
So the A4 amendment, so we'll be reconsidering the A5 amendment. We'll be doing the A4 amendment. They're actually getting the,
all right.
We just got it, and it's going to be passed out. So go ahead and talk about the language.
My association, the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, has been working on something similar to this for the better part of 10 years. Current law allows us two stays of 90 days to work with kids in the criminal justice system. 90 days, 6 months is not nearly long enough to get what we need done with these youth, all right? These are the lesser serious offenders. But they often have multiple issues. They might have mental health issues. They might have chemical dependency issues. They may not have enough time to get COG skills classes done or to pay restitution. So our effort has been to extend those days of adjudication so that we have more time to work with these kids. Current version is an effort that we can support. It's supported by the County Attorneys Association. It's supported by MCA. It's supported by MACAC. It's supported by my organization. And this will go a long ways in giving us more time to work with these kids and offer them the programming that they need so that we can get them on the right track. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Charles Clippert. I'm here from Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm testifying in support of the compromise bill. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 18 years, and I've done some juvenile work as well. And one of the things you see when kids come into juvenile court, especially when they're 16 or 17, I'm thinking of one case in particular. This kid was working at a retail store and letting his buddies go through the checkout line without having them pay for items, so he eventually got charged with a theft. His dad was a doctor. He was a good kid. He was graduating high school and on his way to college. And as we've heard, he was applying for a job, and he got wasn't getting jobs because this theft was coming up, and actually had been reduced from a felony to a gross misdemeanor. So he was in this pocket of having this record on his that was following him around. We eventually had to do a motion to seal it, and we got lucky because a judge granted it. And then one of the problems too with these juvenile records is once they get out into a private like ABC background check company, the judge has no jurisdiction to order those records sealed. So once these records become public, the cat's out of the bag, and it's very hard to get these records back in. So the bill seems to be a good balance between letting the public know about the more serious offenses. It keeps the smaller, lower-level offenses private, so that if someone's caught with someone else's Adderall, that doesn't get out into the world. Low-level thefts. It seems to be a good balance, and I'd ask you to support this the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Hi, my name is Ben Schweigert. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I'm also here this afternoon on behalf of the County Attorneys Association. As Representative Moline said, the current Delete All Amendment is a product of negotiations that we've had with them. The proponents brought forward this original bill, as Representative Moline said, because of concerns about collateral consequences of juvenile proceedings, in particular concerns about data miners who gathered this information and sell it. We and others disagreed with the way that the original version of the bill sought to address these concerns. So now we have on the table an amended bill more narrowly tailored to address these legitimate interests. And it also protects the interests that the county attorneys have sought to protect, the transparency of public processes, the accountability of public officials, and communities' right to access the information about events that affect their lives and their safety. The amended bill will keep open court proceedings. It will keep public records public. Instead, what it does is it allows courts to set certain limits on the way that this information is accessed, in particular, the way that it's accessed through electronic databases. We're very glad that we could reach this agreement. We no longer oppose this bill, and we thank Representative Moline for working with us on this issue.
Thank you. Any other testifiers, Representative Moline?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, the A5 amendment was adopted, but that is not the amendment that the author prefers. The A4, which you all now have, is the preferred language. So the chair would ask for reconsideration of the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And Representative Moline moves the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against these bills, this bill, as amended? Seeing none, questions from members? All right. Seeing none, Representative Moline renews her motion that House File 392, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moline.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal, I think yours is very short, is what I'm hearing. Can we take your bill quick and then Representative Simon, then we'll do yours. Representative Rosenthal, welcome to the committee. The chair moves House File 1051 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Many of you have heard this bill already once, some of you twice. It's a crime victims' rights bill, and it has three basic sections. One, it clarifies harassment and now calls it stalking and makes it a violent crime. It establishes a restitution working group, and it has protections of personal data for crime victims. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I will keep it brief because, as Representative Rosenthal said, I know many of you have heard this already. My name is Kelly Moeller, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, and we seek to improve the criminal justice system's response to crime victims. I've been meeting informally with members of the judicial districts and learning a lot about restitution and some of the problems that we're seeing with respect to requesting, ordering, and collecting restitution. And so I would just emphasize the importance of this restitution working group that would really bring the actors together that are involved in the restitution process. We would invite all of the key stakeholders. Restitution is so important to crime victims. It's important to defendants as well. And we believe that this working group would provide legislative recommendations and also some best practices that could be implemented without legislative action. And so I would just really encourage you to vote for that. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Elwell, Director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs, Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And the remaining portions of the bill are dealing with crime victim rights and a correction to an outdated reference to stalking. In 2010, the legislature changed Section 609.749, renamed that statute from harassment to stalking. However, all the outdated references weren't corrected throughout the statutes, primarily related to the crime victim rights provisions. That's one part. Another part of this bill is that it applies or extends a crime victim right currently applied to victims of violent crime to victims of stalking. Victims of violent crime have the right to against employer retaliation. Victims of violent crime are protected against employer retaliation for time taken off to attend criminal proceedings or civil proceedings related to the crime. That applies to victims of violent crime, and currently stalking is not included in the definition of violent crime under that crime victim right provision. However, it is notably within the definition of violent crime within other statutes. And then finally, this bill would provide protection on the data related to requests for release notification when an offender gets released from a custodial institution. And so the additional provision would fill the gaps in that data protection. Right now, we have protections on some requests for data from some facilities, but not all data for that purposes. And I believe there was an amendment that was drafted. Senator Rosenthal, as a result of a question that came up in the civil law committee, I believe, right? There was a question about whether it was overbroad and that it would place protections on make data private that was related to the offender's release as opposed to the request for the release. And so there is an amendment, and I'll ask Senator Rosenthal.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
This was a request from Representative Holberg, and it's a pretty simple fix. On page 1, line 13, delete notice provided and insert that notice was requested and provided to that person. And I can read that
you
again.
You could repeat that
yes.
Again, Representative Rosenthal.
Page 1, line 13, delete the notice provided and insert the notice was requested and provided to that person.
Okay. Members, do you have that? The chair would move that oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Rosenthal, you also have a dotted line that needs to be filled. Can't send bills to the floor that don't have all their data in them. At least not out of this committee. Line 7.30, page 7. There is a date, January... 2015.
Thanks. Madam Chair, that should read January 15th.
So insert 15. Questions from members? The chair moves that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Rosenthal, I had some concern with Section 9 because it was asking the judicial branch to do something and the state court administrator's office to provide something. So on line 7.11, them participating, and then on 7.14, them providing the data, and I wanted to make certain that there wasn't a fiscal note related to that, and I have been told that they're fine. So it doesn't have a fiscal cost. So questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Simon. The chair would move House File 681 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. It's my understanding, Representative Simon, that the A7 amendment is your amendment.
Yes.
The chair would move the A7 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your time. I need your help. But more importantly, victims of child sex abuse in Minnesota need your help. Right now, they are out of luck and out of time at age 24. That is the state of Minnesota law right now. At age 24, their claims based on their childhood sex abuse are over, done. The courthouse door is slammed in their face, and it doesn't matter what the circumstances. It doesn't matter if the person who did it to them was a repeat offender. Doesn't matter if there was an institution that covered it up or swept it under the rug. Doesn't matter if they were bloodied and bruised and physically harmed. It doesn't matter. At age 24 under Minnesota law, they are out of luck, they cannot confront their accuser, and the courthouse door is slammed shut. We all know that sex abuse obviously is a crime of secrecy. A lot of times victims don't have the courage to speak out until years later, and this is particularly true when the victim is a child. A child, as we know, might lack the emotional skills to come forward, especially when the perpetrator is a family member or another trusted person in the community who uses powerful forms of manipulation. So oftentimes it's only later in life that a child victim will, what I call, sort of connect the dots between the anguish of the present with the crimes and abuses of the past, and I have seen this. I wish, in a perverse way, I wish that members could be in my office or could have been in my office to meet with me and the many, many victims of childhood sex abuse who I've met with, who have broken down in tears in my office. These are people who, in many instances, are just fundamentally damaged people. And I've met with these folks, and they are in their 40s, and they are in their 50s. And these are people who have suffered from childhood sex abuse, but who really have no recourse anymore. And I've seen that suffering, and that's part of what has motivated me to carry this bill today. I don't want to bury you in paper, members, but I wanted to make it quick and easy for you. I have some handouts here. They're color-coded. If you look at the white page, this sort of tells the story. Minnesota law statute section 541.073 subdivision 2. That's in the law books right now. If you were to pull the statute book out in the back of the room, those are the words on the page right now. And if you skip through all the jargon, it basically says the statute of limitations has to be, it means an action has to be commenced within 6 years of the time you connect the dots. 6 years between the time the plaintiff knew or had reason to know that the injury was caused by the abuse. And we as a legislature, not any of us in particular, but we as a legislature passed this in 1989. We were one of the first states to take this approach. Many others followed. It's the so-called delayed discovery rule. And it was kind of a bow to the fact that kids don't connect the dots until later in life. That is just a fact. And that was just emerging then, and it's there's even more evidence for it now. But in 1996, there was a Supreme Court case called the Blachowiak case.
And they interpreted, the Supreme Court in Minnesota interpreted the language I just read you and that's on that white page to mean age 24. Now, I'm not going to relitigate the Blachowiak case. Suffice it to say, I think it was wrongly decided and a really grave injustice. But the law is the law. The Supreme Court has spoken. And there have been many people, including me, since 1996 who have been trying to set it right and go back to something like we had in 1989. How you get 6 years from the time you connect the dots to age 24 is beyond me. But I'm not here to relitigate that case. If you look at the second page, this is from today's paper. County Attorney James Backstrom of Dakota County wrote an op-ed in today's paper, by sheer coincidence, on this bill. You can read it at your leisure. The next page is a pink page. And this was NPR's coverage, but others have covered it too, about the unfolding saga, sad saga, at Shattuck St. Mary's. And if you read the article, I won't have you read it now, it talks not just about the individual perpetrators and the abusers there who were taking advantage of kids. It talks about the culture, the really warped culture at Shattuck St. Mary, which, if these allegations are true, we don't know if they are, but if they're true, is a serious, serious thing. Rug sweeping like you've never seen. People making excuses, not following up. I mean, it took, at one point, one of these abusers was doing this for 2 or 3 years before they finally took any action. And you know what finally did it? It was that someone discovered child porn on this guy's computer. It wasn't the many complaints. It wasn't the rumors. That's the kind of culture that we're confronting in some of these institutions. If you look at the green sheet, this is from Los Angeles, and this shows you why the statute of limitations is very important. This was from litigation, recent litigation, that was unearthed the memos from the 80s. And if you look at about the fourth, fifth paragraph, just read that. It says, this is a memo to the Archbishop Mahoney. It says, the young boy involved is now about 18, so Kevin, that's the person who allegedly perpetrated these horrible crimes, Kevin should certainly not return for another 2 years, by which time the period for filing lawsuits will have passed. Explicit mention in memo of, just shuttle him off somewhere, wait till the statute of limitations is passed, and then we'll be good to go. And some of you may be wondering, well, that's California. We do things differently here in Minnesota. Look at the yellow sheet. That's the final one, and then I'll leave you alone with the paper. This is from Minnesota from the 1980s, and if you look at the second page on the back, at the top of the page, look at this. It is my recommendation, given the seriousness of our exposure, that the Archdiocese posture itself in such a way that any publicity will be minimized. I would recommend that in cooperation with Bishop Waters, that Father Adamson be sent to the Paracletes in Albuquerque, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, shuttle the guy off somewhere, cover it up, sweep it under the rug. And by the way, anyone who were abused by these folks, either at Shattuck St. Mary's in the late 90s and early 2000s, or in this Minnesota case from the 1980s, they are out of luck. They're all over 24. And after the Blachowiak case, they have zero recourse, zero. They cannot confront their accuser. So the original bill, the one that County Attorney Backstrom wrote about in today's paper, and by the way, the form that it's still in the Senate, it's on the floor in its original form, no amendments, says no statute of limitations whatsoever. Let's just get rid of it like we do for the most serious of crimes and civil actions like wrongful death and others. Just get rid of it altogether. That would be my preferred version. It's the one that I still think is the right thing to do, but I think I've listened, I've learned, I've heard, I've talked with stakeholders, I've met as recently with them as yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock in my office, and will continue to do so if it takes nights and weekends, if we can get agreement. So I listened, and in the last committee, at the urging in particular of our chair here today and Chair Lesch of the Civil Law Committee, they both urged me to being good vote counters and understanding some of the things we need to do. I pared the bill way back. And some of you have already approached me and said you thought I went too far the other way in paring it back and giving up the fight. But what we did is we said from now on with this bill, no more so-called forever liability. Now what we did is we eliminated the statute of limitations only into the future. So if this goes into effect August 1st, 2013, it would only eliminate the statute of limitations for sex abuse against kids that happens on or after that date, and even then, only for fault, only for negligence, not for so-called vicarious liability, which is a legal theory that says that, you know, the institution that employs someone under certain circumstances might be on the hook. So only for negligence, which is fault, which is the kind of stuff you saw in these memos and that you're reading about in these articles, and only for future conduct. We do, however, create a 3-year window. It's called a window. We've done this twice before, once in 1989, once in 1991. We haven't done it for 22 years. What we do is we create a window of 3 years, so we revive otherwise time-barred claim for only 3 years, and that gets at the concern that the institutions we all know and love, that I'm sure have talked to some of you and met with you in your offices, say they had a problem with from an insurance standpoint and another standpoint, which is they were saying, look, if you go on forever, we won't know what the end of our liability is. How can we plan? How can we know? This gives them that finality. It would mean that as of August 1st, 2016, they would know who has already come forward and who has filed a claim. I would argue it's still unfair as to those who might be too young yet to realize what's happened to them, but I'm willing to go there as a compromise to keep this bill moving. And now the A7 amendment that we just put on is a further compromise that I know you, Madam Chair, and some other stakeholders felt strongly about. It has to do with making sure that if the actual alleged perpetrator, the individual, is a juvenile, particularly under the age of consent, which is Minnesota, in Minnesota is 16, that we exempt any changes that this bill makes for them as well. And so the institutions can know that if they've hired someone who did a very, very bad thing, a 16-year-old or 15-year-old or whatever, that that institution will not be on the hook. At least this law will not change the circumstances by which they're on the hook. So that's the A7 amendment, members, which, again, the Senate didn't do. The Senate whisked this away to the floor in its pristine original state, and that's not what we've done here, and I think I've more than accommodated many of the opponents of this bill. So there are others who want to talk about that. I would just remember that oftentimes the civil cases are the hook to make sure that we can get at people criminally as well. And we know from the statistics that child molesters and perpetrators of these crimes who go uncaught and unpunished will very likely molest again and again and again. So I ask you to help me in making sure that people past the age of 24 can get some justice, can make sure that they can confront their accusers, particularly where, or confront those who have perpetrated this abuse, particularly where there is an institution that has aided and abetted the cover-up and oftentimes directly or indirectly given aid and comfort to the perpetrators. So I thank you, and I think, I don't know if he's here yet, Representative Erickson, who's a co-author of mine on the bill, I don't know if she was going to be able to make it, apparently not. She was going to testify, but Madam Chair, I don't know what your pleasure is with respect to other testifiers, but if it's okay with the Chair, the next testifier in favor of this bill would be Paul Dimmitt.
Okay. Representative Simon, why don't you bring your testifiers down, and
sure.
We have a long list of folks that want to testify now. This is an issue that people feel very strongly about, and members, this is here because it gives them the ability to file an additional suit in court, and it's my understanding that there is not a fiscal note for this because they don't, there isn't enough cases that would warrant additional court costs.
That's right.
So, Representative Simon, we're going to try to keep you narrow and short. So welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Dimmitt. I am here to speak in favor of the Minnesota Child Victims Act, House File 681. As an adolescent, I was sought after. I was befriended. I was taught. I was coached. I was directed. I was groomed. And I was sexually abused by an English high school teacher who also was my speech coach and my theater director. During this time, I didn't understand what was happening. I knew that the relationship was not appropriate, but I was afraid to say anything. The process of sexually abusing me was not only an invasion of my body, but it was of my mind and of my soul as well. Not understanding what was going on at the time, I only escaped from 6 years of abuse by graduating from that high school and leaving for college. At what point I tried to live my life as if nothing had happened, but I was making poor decisions, poor choices, and along the way I was hurting a lot of people, to the point where I was so frustrated with my own life and my own actions and acting out that I decided that it wasn't worth living anymore. So I was on Interstate 94, and some of you know where that is, and the accelerator pedal was pushed to the floor, and I had the intent of driving my vehicle into the side of a bridge embankment. What made me stop, I still don't quite understand, other than a divine intervention from my wife, who said, come pick me up. I had a suicide note written. Not in that note did I once mention anything about sexual abuse. And it was after 2 weeks of being in the hospital under crisis intervention that a doctor had explained to me that what had happened to me was a grooming process by someone who is experienced at doing this with other people. And it was sexual abuse. And he asked me if this person was still teaching, and I said yes. and he said, if he's still teaching, he's probably still abusing. As soon as I understood that, I made a call to the police department. The police investigated, questioned him multiple times. Finally, he broke down after hearing my call in to the police department. And he confessed. He was arrested. He was convicted criminally. And during that process, he admitted to abusing up to 100 other children. Not only did I learn that he abused up to 100 other children, but the school had learned about him before I was abused and reports after I was abused. Armed with that knowledge, I decided to do a civil lawsuit, which progressed through the state Supreme Court, and it was thrown out. Summary judgment, time barred. I was too late. And if that wasn't pain enough, I was also ordered by that court to pay a restitution or judgment fee for the legal costs of the person that abused me and the institutions that had to get legal representation. So I strongly urge you to consider this bill on its merit for what it's designed to do. It's designed to help people when they're ready to come forward, when they have an understanding, so that they can find some way to move on with their life and make a difference in someone else's. I thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Dion. I serve as the Deputy Executive Director of the National Center for Victims of Crime. We're the nation's leading resource and advocacy organization serving victims of all types of crime. I want to give you a little perspective on where Minnesota sits in relation to the rest of the country with regards to the civil statute of limitation for child sexual abuse. 41 states have recognized the unique dynamics of child sexual abuse and created special statutes of limitation for child sex abuse cases. And the statute of limitation is, of course, it's like a stopwatch, and the question is, when does that clock start ticking and when does it stop ticking? 4 states have already completely eliminated the civil statute of limitation for child sex abuse. 3 other states have already created these civil windows that allow old cases to come forward. There's still only about 15 states that still use a fixed number of years statute of limitation, and the greatest of those is Connecticut, where victims have up until 30 years from the age of majority to file a civil lawsuit. 25 states use what is known as a delayed discovery rule, the connecting the dots that Representative Simon talked about. This is the rule that most states use and which works well, and it's the rule that Minnesota had until that Supreme Court case changed the interpretation of that statute. And that Supreme Court decision brought Minnesota from being from a mainstream moderate statute of limitations to a state that has one of the most restrictive civil statute of limitations in the country. Survivors of child sexual abuse have an increased incidence of drug and alcohol addiction, sex addiction, depression, anxiety, eating disorders, post-traumatic stress, and suicide. And these resulting harms are often latent injuries that don't even manifest themselves until the victim is well into adulthood. And just as working with asbestos might result in lung cancer 30 years later, a child who's been sexually abused may not recognize the harm they suffered until decades later. Many victims, particularly boys, are much less likely to report the abuse as being harmful at the time it occurred. It makes sense when you consider a child's notion and understanding of what harm is. An 8 or 10 or 12-year-old boy might think, well, that was weird, that was kind of gross, but I'm alive, I'm breathing, I'm not bleeding, I don't have any broken bones, I guess I'm okay. And it often takes decades before the victim recognizes that their experience was abuse, realize how they were harmed by that abuse, or even simply just find the strength to come forward. When victims do come forward, just as Paul found out, and they want to report, they find that the statute of limitations has expired. The statute of limitations is a legal loophole that lets abusers run out the clock and avoid accountability for their actions. And the Child Victims Act will eliminate the civil statute and create that three-year window so abusers, so victims can sue their abuser and the institution that negligently failed to prevent the abuse, no matter how long ago the abuse occurred. It is critically important to allow these old cases to come forward in order to protect children today. Because even when it takes 30 years for a victim to come forward, as in Paul's case, when they do come forward and the perpetrator's still alive, we often find that they're still molesting kids because pedophiles don't retire. And when it's only when we allow these cases to come forward and then other victims will come forward and say, it happened to me too, and they haven't before because they thought that nobody would believe them, or they thought they were the only one that it happened to. And oftentimes what happens is a survivor will come forward who is within the criminal statute of limitations, and that person can be criminally prosecuted. Institutions are the last line of defense to keep predators from kids. They've got a duty to screen people before they give them access to children, to supervise them and make sure they are acting appropriately, and to remove them and report them to the police at the first instance of sexual abuse. Too often, we see private institutions try and keep things quiet and focus on protecting the reputation of the institution rather than protecting kids. And this is a crime that breeds in secrecy. Keeping it quiet only perpetuates the abuse. Now, I say private institutions because public institutions are less able to hide information. And as a result, they have not engaged in conduct which has subjected them to liability. Additionally, public institutions are protected by sovereign immunity, and they have caps on their liability. Now, I'm sure that you'll hear that it's unfair and impractical to defend old cases, that the witnesses are dead and the files have been destroyed, which puts the defendants at a disadvantage. In fact, the opposite is true. A case such as this would fail because the victim has the burden of proof. Without any corroborating evidence, a civil case would likely not survive preliminary motions. If the statute of limitations is eliminated, victims do not automatically win. They simply get the chance to prove their case. Yet under the current law, even if there is an admission by the abuser or video evidence, the abuser can escape accountability by hiding behind the statute of limitations. Don't be swayed by claims of opponents who argue that insurance will not cover old claims and that many charitable organizations will be driven out of business. The reality is that the overwhelming majority of child sex abuse lawsuits are voluntarily settled by defendants. Those defendants don't settle a case for more money or insurance coverage than they have available, and they do not settle until they are convinced that there is sufficient evidence to hold them liable in court. Some will also argue that a public policy that uses a short statute of limitation to encourage orderly reporting. But that's the policy we have in place now, and the results speak for themselves. The current statute of limitations helps no one but abusers and those that protect them. Child molesters hide behind that short statute of limitation and use it to their advantage. They know they don't have to keep victims quiet forever. They just have to keep them quiet long enough to run out the clock. This bill is an important step forward that will help protect children and offer an opportunity for justice for those who are victimized in the past, and I urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you. Representative Simon, do you have a few more testifiers?
We do have a couple. I don't know.
Well, Representative Simon, we just want to make sure we have enough time for the opponents to have equal time. So if your next testifiers would come to the table, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Brosnahan. I'm the Kanabec County Attorney. I wish that I was here and I could say that cases, experiences like Mr. Dimmitt's are rare, but they're not. In my 10 years of experience prosecuting criminal sexual conduct cases, in fact, they're common. In a county the size of Kanabec County, I'm actually half of the criminal division of the county, which means that for most of the last 10 years, I've spent significant portion of time prosecuting sex crimes against children. I'm here today because my study of the dynamics of these kinds of cases has led me to conclude that as a matter of policy and justice for survivors demands that as a state, we not limit their freedom to confront their abusers. that we not keep victims out of the courthouse, that we not provide legal safe havens for people who perpetrate against them and the institutions that help them do it. The second reason that I'm here is for the safety of my community and other communities like mine. Criminal sexual conduct cases of this kind are perpetrated by people who commit these crimes again and again and again. Every tool that is available to expose such a perpetrator, we should be using to keep our communities safe. And it's not just, and this leads me to my third point, which is the fiscal point. It's not just the individual victim. The individual victim, as you heard testimony, is much, much more likely to suffer from all kinds of really costly problems. From a county perspective, the mental health issues that we have, the child protection issues that we have, the law enforcement, all these costs that we bear directly relate to our inability to protect kids. So I'm here today because there are hundreds of children, thousands of children. We should not be providing a loophole, a safe haven for those who perpetrate against them. It's costing us enormously in terms of the moral imperative and the fiscal cost that we're paying. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We are here today to support this bill. I thank Representative Simon for bringing this bill, and I also thank Mr. Dimmitt for coming forward to share his story. I just want to remind the committee about the cost of sexual violence report that came out a few years ago from the Department of Health. It stated that there were 61,000 victims of sexual assault in the state of Minnesota. Of those, 17,000 were children. And if you think about it, that number could fill the Xcel Energy Center down the street. MnCASA represents over 70 sexual assault crisis centers throughout the state. The advocates who work at these centers see these victims as survivors of rape, child sexual abuse, and other forms of sexual violence every day. These advocates hear these painful personal stories, and they realize that these victims haven't had an opportunity to tell others because they're ashamed. They don't want to be shunned by their family or their community. Often the disclosures do not tell of immediate harm. They come from many, many years back, as we've heard of today. So we're really just here to say that we believe these children have been victims, they've been powerless, and they need an opportunity to find the safety and justice that they were due. They were hurt and betrayed by the people who were there to teach them and mentor them and support them in their community, and we would like them to have an opportunity now to address the harm and to do so when they are ready to do so on their own terms. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the county attorney from Kennebec, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. I didn't write it down.
Amy Brosnahan.
Okay, Ms. Brosnahan. I had a question. You mentioned the cases that you've worked with. And child sex abuse cases that you've dealt with, what percentage, or what, even if you don't have, if it's just anecdotal, what percentage of those have you found that the institution, there was some institutional cover-up for those perpetrators?
The cases that I've did, percentage, what, anecdotally, minimal. There have been cases where the institutional response once a crime is, once they learn what's happening, the response has not been what it should be. But the experience that I have individually deals mostly with individual perpetrators. The dynamic is that when a child comes forward, the institution, whether it's just the family or the institutions or school or a church or place where this is happening, nobody wants this to have happened. And so there is huge effort to, well, first, what most often happens is folks try to blame it on the child. The child must be lying, or there must be something wrong with that child, or that child's got trouble. So there's often an effort, not necessarily to cover it up, but to cast aspersions on the child, to minimize consequences to a perpetrator if it's a person who's well-regarded, powerful, important. The kinds of suits I think that are anticipated by this bill, I can think of a whole bunch of individuals who would be who aren't ready now, who won't even be ready in a couple years, but several years from now, as Mr. Dimmitt was describing, when they're ready, there are individual perpetrators that they will want to answer in a way that, as a child in the criminal justice system, they couldn't have the kind of voice that they would be able to have later.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Ms. Palmer. If you could please restate those statistics that you shared and from what the source of those are, and I'm wondering, given the numbers were startling, I didn't even write them down. I was like, wondering if Representative Simon, thank you, has considered those and in drafting this legislation, wondering if your legislation would significantly reach the child victims in this.
First, Ms. Palmer. Representative, the numbers come from the Minnesota Department of Health. It's the cost of sexual violence report. It came out in 2007, and the statistics are for the year 2005. The total statistics were 61,000 victims of sexual assault in the state, with an estimate of just a little over 17,000 being children.
Representative Simon, do you want to take the second part of that question?
Sure. I've heard those figures before, Representative Pugh, and it's hard to say how many would be benefited from this bill. I hope many. I just don't know. I mean, who knows how many would come forward? I don't know the answer. I don't know.
Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I heard Ms. Palmer say 17,000 children. Is that annually or is that cumulatively?
That's in
Ms.
one Palmer. Year. Madam Chair, 2005, 1 year.
Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess the question is, and it would take us a little bit off track, but the question is around the fiscal note. If there's 17,000 children per year, I find it difficult to believe that there would not be a fiscal impact to this bill. So, Madam Chair, did we actually, was there one actually physically asked for?
Representative Dreskowski, I just conferred, no, but we did consult.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, why are we not asking for a fiscal note for a bill that could have an impact on a significant share of 17,000 children per year?
Happy to do it, Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
My understanding, too, though, is that, you know, only a very small fraction of people actually come forward in the civil system. There are other reasons why they might not want to. The last time, and I forget what the figure is, but the last time we had a window in 1991, very few, a tiny, tiny, tiny sliver came forward then. There may be all sorts of reasons that experts with a lot more qualifications than I do could talk about why that is. But if the past is any prediction of the future, and maybe it isn't, it's only a small number that would come forward.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Palmer.
And I would concur with that as well. From our experience at MnCASA, the number of people who do come forward is quite low, again, for various reasons, feeling ashamed, feeling blame, not wanting to go forward for various reasons. But we just wanted to provide that number to show that it is a problem in our state that we need to address.
Other questions for members? Otherwise, I'm going to go to opposition testimony. All right. Representative Simon, we'll call you back as soon as we hear from the opposition. So if you're opposed, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead. More than one of you can come to the table at once so that we don't have to. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Bockelman. I am a pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, now retired, and I serve as chair of the Minnesota Religious Council, which is a consortium representing the six Minnesota synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Minnesota South District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, United Methodists in Minnesota, and Roman Catholics in Minnesota. I also served for 11 years as assistant to the bishop in the Northeastern Minnesota Synod, where my responsibilities had to do with clergy sexual misconduct and with congregations in conflict. I want to make absolutely clear that the churches that are part of the Minnesota Religious Council have zero tolerance for the sexual abuse of children by clergy and other religious professionals. It is a violation of all that our faith professes, and we know it has a traumatic impact on victims, families, congregations, and communities. We want nothing more than to end the sexual abuse of children by those whose very calling is to protect the most vulnerable among us. To that end, our churches have worked diligently to develop policies and procedures to receive allegations of abuse, identify abusers and remove them from positions of trust, offer healing to victims, and put in place safe church programs to prevent future abuse. We're open to hearing any allegation of abuse at any time. No report is ignored. We comply with mandated reporting laws in reporting the abuse of children to the appropriate authorities, and we cooperate with criminal investigations. Alleged abusers are removed from work with children while under investigation, and when the abuse is proved, are removed from public ministry. We tell the truth to congregations present and past and to church leadership so that abusers are not passed on from one place to another. As part of our prevention programs, we comply with laws regarding background checks on clergy and go beyond those laws to include more stringent background checks on religious professionals, those preparing for ministry, other church employees, and volunteers. And we mandate power and boundaries training for church professionals. We teach leaders and members to recognize the warning signs of abuse. We assist our congregations in developing safe church practices, in screening, hiring, training, monitoring of employees and volunteers, in establishing activity policies that prevent the isolation and secrecy that are needed by abusers. We have worked to create faith communities where children are surrounded by caring adults who protect and advocate for them and know their responsibility to report suspected abuse. We do all of this because the abuse of even one child is one child too many. We're committed to doing this work. We work with a coalition, including child care and school organizations and others, and we do have some concerns about this proposed legislation. We are not concerned about extending the statute of limitations for perpetrators of abuse who ought indeed to be held accountable. But we are concerned about those kinds of situations where the passage of time may indeed make it difficult to find adequate evidence for a case to be fairly adjudicated. We would prefer reasonable parameters so that we can find that adequate evidence and so that those who have been abused also have access to that. I want to thank Representative Simon for his continued conversation with us about possible compromises. We have offered compromise positions that we feel do allow those reasonable parameters so that cases can be adjudicated. I also want to say that we are concerned about anything that could have a negative impact on the early reporting of abuse. Or to put it another way, anything we could do to encourage early reporting of abuse is something that we want to work toward. That might mean, for example, strengthening mandatory reporting laws and mandatory training programs for clergy and lay ministry personnel, for volunteers, parents, children, and youth, all of those that are involved. The earlier abuse is reported, the more quickly the allegation can be investigated, the perpetrator identified and removed from a position of trust, the victim given access to resources for healing, and thus the more likely it is that future abuse and additional victims can be prevented. The starting point for all of us is that we want to see perpetrators brought to justice. We want to see victims healed. We want to see church and youth-serving organizations be able to continue to serve faithfully, and we want future abuse to be prevented. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Go ahead and try not to repeat anything that was in the previous testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. It's a representative organization of 2,200 elected public school board officials. I am here to share their commitment and concerns about the impact of this bill. MSBA has promised the victims in 2007 that we would work on toughening up the laws to protect children. We did, in fact, do that through a couple bills. The first one was felony teacher reporting without pay and toughening up background checks for parents, volunteers, and anyone working alone with a child. But with that, we have concerns about the civil liability if a district is found to be an employer of record known to this. This bill creates a three-year window where old cases could be brought forward. That could be cases from the 50s and 60s. Paperwork, documentation, staff, the folks that were alive when the event occurred may not even be available to school districts. Schools would have to come up with dollars for attorney's fees as well as investigation fees concerning any case, even to find out basic pieces of it. Those would come out of the general classroom. The one area we are allowed to pass on is if, in fact, a court judgment is found, we are able to levy it against the taxpayers of the school district. Saying that, our second big concern with this is that the increase in future insurance policies going forward, unlike cities and counties, schools cannot levy for any of those additional costs going forward. They have to, once again, come out of the classroom. And lastly, I just want to ask you a question. Given the limitations of what this bill would mean for school districts, you might find today's students, staff, and community paying for issues that happened in yesteryear. And we support following up with the perpetrator, and we promise to continue our commitment to doing that. But we certainly have grave concerns about what this could mean for every school district across the state. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. MCCA is the association representing the licensed child care centers throughout Minnesota. As you've heard from other testifiers, MCCA has concerns about this legislation. Just to give you a little background, licensed child care centers, like many, obviously place the highest priority on ensuring children's safety, and we must meet numerous requirements in state law in order to be licensed. Current requirements include mandatory background studies on all staff, minimum student-staff ratio requirements, mandatory development of risk assessment and risk reduction plans, mandatory emergency and accident plans, mandatory unannounced licensing inspections and investigations of complaints, and mandated reporting under the Maltreatment of Minors Act. Child care centers also undertake numerous voluntary safety precautions. including staff training on various child safety measures, security systems in buildings, and policies and procedures on who has access to the buildings and classrooms. MCCA has concerns about the bill, and we do appreciate Representative Simon's willingness to meet with us and willing to consider various compromises proposed. We do still have concerns about the three-year window. The reason why is over time, records may not be kept, a company or center may no longer exist, or may have been taken over by another organization, and individuals and roles in authority have died or their whereabouts unknown. As a result, it becomes more difficult to establish the facts and to prove allegations. Without these, it becomes nearly impossible for a child care center to adequately defend itself. Now, you know, this is a very difficult issue, and my heart goes out to the victims. And I understand concerns about the current law. What I'm hoping is that we can continue to work with the members and Representative Simon on trying to find a balance between what's in current law and having a three-year open window where 40-year-old cases might be tried. And I'm available for questions, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Any other testifiers? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Robert McCullum. Excuse me. I'm an attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. Good afternoon. You know, over the years, I've carried a number of different hats, one of which is an attorney, one of which is being on a board of a gymnastics club, one of which was running a t-ball league for my daughter. And those all happened about 20 to 25 years ago. And when I read this bill, it struck me that because of the position that I held with those different organizations, I would be exposed to a lawsuit if some coach in either those in the gymnastics club or in the t-ball league abused a child, because it was on my watch. And how would I defend that case if somebody brought the case against me and said, you are vicariously liable, because this is what's possible if you open up this three-year window that we're talking about here? How would I defend myself? Would I go back and to my homeowner's policy that I have now and say, okay, I've been sued, here's the complaint, defend me? They're not going to defend me, because it's an occurrence-based policy, which means the occurrence has to take place within the policy year. So I have to go back and take a look at what policies were in existence 25 to 30 years ago. Can I find my policies that go back that far to tender the claim to them? I can't find those policies. I don't know where they are and whether they would even cover it. Does the association have policies that go back that far? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But finding them is virtually impossible. So what would happen then? I would be left to defend myself. I assume that perhaps all of you have served on organizations like that, nonprofit organizations and clubs, church groups, you know, hockey leagues, whatever. And what happens if some individual, some person now, because of this law, 20 to 25 years later, says, you're going to be responsible because it was on your watch? What are you going to do? Well, I can tell you, if you hire an attorney, that attorney is going to have an associate attorney, is going to have a paralegal, and it's going to cost you thousands and thousands of dollars. And who's going to want to then volunteer, and we would apply this law prospectively, who would want to volunteer for organizations such as that? But the cost of these is not only just the attorney and the associate attorney and the paralegal, it's the expert witnesses, it's the court costs, it's the depositions that come into play, because, and it's expensive. And who bears the burden of that? The organizations, the nonprofit organizations. We tend to be focused on certain institutions here in the discussion that we're having about this, But this bill goes way beyond that. It goes to your organizations. If you read the definition of persons in this bill, I suggest that you read that. It doesn't say certain institutions. It says almost anybody. So if you had a son who was 17 years old at the time that, and he was living in your house and he was in your basement and he was having relationships with a girl who's 15, and it happened on your watch, you're one of those persons under this bill that are going to be exposed for the next 3 years. Now, I heard one of the other testifiers say, well, geez, they have the burden of proof to say that this is that this will occur. It's going to be more difficult for the plaintiffs, and these cases would be dismissed on summary judgment motions. I've represented people who have been assaulted. I've represented people who have been sued because of assaults. And I can tell you that the burden of proof is truly on the plaintiff. But they're not going to be dismissed on a summary judgment motion because it's a fact question of whether it happens. Summary judgment motions apply to issues of law when there is no question of fact. But if somebody says it happened and somebody says it's not, it didn't, it goes to the jury. And how much money does it cost to go through a trial these days? And beyond that is the issue of insurance coverage, as I mentioned. Your policies that you have today will not cover these types of claims because they go back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when the occurrence takes place, because these are occurrence-based policies. You have to find a policy that would provide you with a defense, and if you can't, it's going to be out of your own pocket to defend yourself, rightly or wrongly. Now, with respect to the issue of the statute of limitations, generally speaking, aside from this 3-year window that we're talking about for allowing to bring vicarious liability claims, whether you've committed any act, misconduct or not, just because of the position that you're in, you're exposed to liability if you let this 3-year window exist. Anybody could be exposed under those circumstances. But if you're talking about the general statute of limitations, there are several Supreme Court cases that have addressed the purposes of the statute of limitations, and I'd just like to quote those cases. In the case of United States versus Kubrick, it's a 1979 case. It cites to a case from 1879 and says that statutes of limitations are found in all systems of enlightened jurisprudence. They are necessary to protect defendants and the courts from having to deal with cases in which the search for truth, and that's what we're about here, is the search for truth. Did it happen or not? And trust me, I mean, there are cases where these things don't happen. We've been talking about the cases today where they do happen. But if you're a defendant and you say it didn't happen, or if the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, is no longer alive, then the question becomes how do you prove that those claims aren't true? And you talk about the burden of proof. The burden of proof in a case is on the plaintiff, and the plaintiff gets up and says it's true, but your defendant, the alleged perpetrator, isn't alive. They've met their burden of proof because you can't disprove it. And is that fair? And is that balanced? The court said they are necessary to protect defendants and the courts from having to deal with cases in which the search for truth may be seriously impaired by the loss of evidence, whether by death or disappearance of witnesses, fading memories, disappearance of documents, or otherwise. And that can happen for reasons that are wrong, but it can happen simply by reason of the passage of time. So if you're going to write a bill that's going to address the kinds of issues we've been hearing about today, then write that bill. But don't write a bill that makes it difficult for nonprofits and associations and clubs to defend themselves in cases and situations where they've done nothing wrong. But that's what you're doing here today. If you pass this bill along, that's what you will be doing. You will be rubber stamping that, and you will be exposing your clubs and organizations and associations and your nonprofits to the cost of having defense, which may be meritless.
Thank you for your testimony.
Ma'am, I have just one other point that I think would be worth addressing.
1 minute.
If I might. I have read the amendment that has been provided by Representative Simon, and I just wanted to comment that I am concerned that the amendment perhaps creates a situation of exposure to institutions that perhaps was not intended, because in paragraph 3, it's line 1.5 of the amendment. It refers to must be commenced within 6 years the alleged sexual abuse in a case where the defendant is 16 years old or younger. And obviously the defendant is referenced there as an individual. And because it's limited to an individual, it could open up exposure to institutions for that type of activity. And I think that needs to be addressed further. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League does not have an official position on this bill, but we do have some concerns with it. And I know you asked us not to repeat things, but I would like to thank Representative Simon for his willingness to work with organizations' concerns on this and his thoughtfulness throughout the process. The amendment he offered in the previous committee does do a lot of things that we thought were necessary. Very briefly, we do have concerns that were similar to previous testifiers about the three-year window, which does allow older claims for vicarious liability where there's no allegation of negligence against a municipality or a school district. And as the most other testifiers have said, it's really an unknown how many of these claims might come forward, and that is a concern we have with liability for our municipalities.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I will try and be brief. I first want to make it clear we have no concerns about extending the statute of limitations as far as the perpetrator goes. We also share the concerns that were indicated by Representative Simon about the court negating the current provision of the law that extended the statute of limitations to such 6 years after the time that the victim had knew or had reason to know the injury. And to that end, all the organizations that just have appeared here to replace that existing law have volunteered to more than triple the current statute of limitations from 6 to 18 years. In addition, with regards to retroactivity, we have also volunteered to allow a window that would cover events that would go back more than 20 years. So we have indicated that we are more than willing to compromise on this. What we cannot compromise is simply an unlimited period of time going back 40, 50, 30 years for all the reasons that have been stated previously. Counties share the concerns about what has occurred to these victims. We are the entities that prosecute these perpetrators criminally. To the extent that their sentences are stayed, we are the ones who incur the cost for their incarceration and much of the cost for their probation or supervision out in the community. And to the extent that they are civilly committed, we are the ones that prosecute those cases and pay 25% of the cost of their hospitalization and treatment. We incur substantial cost. We do have concerns about this bill with its 3-year window. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you. Questions from members? Members, the next committee comes in at 4 o'clock. I'm hoping that we can hear Representative Sundin's bill before we do that, and then we'll only have Representative Liebling's bill to hear tonight. But we're going to finish the agenda today. So questions from members? Representative Scott?
Thank you. And I want to clear something up because I'm going back and forth with this amendment and with what was said and Representative Simon. What I thought I heard you say that the amendment does, and then some of the testifiers made me doubt. And I just have a couple of questions. You said that they were not going to, this amendment would say that you can't go back forever. I believe that's what you said. Am I right?
Representative Simon?
No, that's not what I said.
Okay.
Representative Scott?
Thank you. Could you clear that up? How far it goes back?
Yes, I want to
Representative Simon.
Two things as to what Mr. McCollum said. I think his concern, I guess I see what he's saying in terms of being clarifying it. I can't move it. I'm not on the committee, but if someone wants to make the amendment that before the word defendant on what was the A7 amendment on line 1.6, you could say individual defendant to make sure it doesn't apply to a defendant at this institution, that might cure that particular problem in case there was any confusion.
Sure. Members, does anyone object to that oral amendment being offered? Okay, Representative Lesh moves the amendment to add the word individual on line 1.6 after the word the. Is that correct, Representative Simon?
Correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so, Representative Simon, what time frames were changed by this amendment from the, I don't know, second engrossment, it looks like?
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I assume, Representative Scott, you're not talking about the A7 amendment. You're talking about the amendment that went on in the last committee. Or are you talking
about the A7.
Oh, no, no time frame was changed here. All that A7 did was address the concerns of some stakeholders, Representative Hillstrom and others, about what happens if the actual individual, the individual human perpetrator, is under 18, or in this case, under 16. That's all it did.
Okay. Thank
but,
you.
Madam Chair, if I may,
Representative Simon.
Because this dovetails with, I think, what your question is getting at, too. I just feel the need to respond to Mr. McCollum. I'm a little disappointed. I think he ought to have known better, and he did appear before the last testimony, last hearing, and I never heard the T-ball defense before. But here we go. Members, every board, commission, park rec league, everything you've ever served on, I guarantee you, has directors and officers liability insurance. Mine do. I've been involved in those same organizations. This isn't people. You're not going to be on the hook because you served on the T-ball league. Nice try, though. There is no vicarious, the vicarious liability wouldn't enter into it in this context at all. Besides which, even if someone did bring you in, you could always yank someone else into the lawsuit saying it's not my fault, it's there. You could seek someone else out in terms of indemnification. I understand it's probably a rhetorically effective tool to cast out in your mind that somehow your T-ball leagues, you're going to be called in 40 years later for a 7-year-old T-baller. I really hope that you're not persuaded by that. This bill, I would say, generally is, frankly, way watered down from what it was introduced as. As introduced, it was no statute of limitations, period, forward, backwards, or sideways. Now we're saying, going forward, it's only as to sexual abuse that occurs after the enactment date, and even then, only for negligence. So this bit about the T-ball and vicarious liability, that's gone. Totally gone. Now, looking back, it's true that a window is opened up, and that would allow otherwise stale claims to come forward, but only for 3 years, only 3 years, so there's finality, which is what people want from the standpoint of insurance and planning and all the rest. So there's a beginning, middle, and end. And as of 2016, if this bill passes, everyone will know what their exposure is for past events going back 100 years or more, I guess.
Thank you, Representative. I just want to make sure we have time for members' questions. Other questions from members? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, thank you for bringing the bill. You know, where I come from, I know a lot of volunteers and a lot of organizations. I don't think they all have the liability insurance you talk about. I'd be rather certain of that. Without asking them, I would question that for sure. We have this, and this bill has opened it up for, a person is... any natural person, corporation, limited liability company, partnership, organization, association, or other entity. That's everybody and anybody that has any organization of any sort in the state. That part is problematic. Representative Simon, maybe you can help me answer this, or maybe you know. I would expect you do, given your line of work. Is there a way, or would there be a way to write this this bill that you would require that the individual or the organization was found criminally guilty first before allowing them to pursue the civil liabilities, the civil judgment?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Druskowski, I don't know. I don't know about that. That being a trigger for a civil liability, I don't know how we would write that. Obviously, one of the problems you get here is there's a different standard of proof. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. As I understand your question, you're saying as a trigger to going forward with a civil lawsuit, you'd have to have a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Simon. I'd encourage you to pursue something that helps us winnow this down to people who have a high probability of being guilty of what they do so that we don't have all of that exposure for false allegations that was talked about. I'm just afraid of what this might do because of that. I think if we looked at a different solution like that, it might be something that would have a lot broader support. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Representative Simon did mention that he'd worked with me and with several other members on this. And I understand the concerns from both sides. On the one side, I recognize the fear of individuals who are or institutions that are exposed to liability. Absolutely. And we remember stories of false charges, of false accusations, and it offends our sensibilities of justice, our sense of justice, and our sense of right and wrong when that kind of thing happens. And I was trying to recall instances of that, of high-profile instances of those things occurring, and I remember a discussion of the Scott County sex abuse allegations in 1983. And now I only remember those of recollection because it was started by a 10-year-old boy who had these accusations of weird things going on in the woods, and expanded to 19 people being indicted by the Scott County attorney at the time in 1983. All those charges were subsequently dismissed. And there was an attorney general investigation report in 1985, which I was able to pull up right here and peruse briefly as some of the testifiers were speaking. It was compared to a witch hunt, a witch trial. We have come a long way since then. And I'm trying to recall if the other instances of false accusations since then. Sometimes you hear of a stray one in a child custody dispute. One parent accuses the other falsely of this. But then, members, I think of the other side. And I think of the examples of all the people that got away with the wrongs, whether they were institutions of transferring priests with full knowledge of what is going on. I have personal experience of that happening in my life, and of other organizations or institutions as well. And I try to weigh, as we do here on the scales of justice, what weighs more. And there is absolutely, absolutely no question about which direction the scales are tilted and have been tilted. And they're tilted against the victims, not against the institutions. And what Representative Simon's bill is trying to do is it's trying to rebalance the scale. I think the compromise language of a three-year window is probably appropriate. I have had concerns addressed to me by individuals whom I respect in the church hierarchy with whom I deal with. But as a matter of justice for our constituents, the people of Minnesota, I think you're doing the right thing. I think you've come a long way from the direction the original bill took, Representative Simon, and maybe it'll be polished up even after this committee. You've shown yourself to be willing to do that in the past, and maybe will in the future too. But as it stands right now, I can support it.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, the chair renews the motion that House File 681 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Sundin, members, we're going to try to get through this bill if we can. We have a very small section in this bill. The only section that we have, we're getting, this is actually the engrossed copy. The copy that you had was not the engrossed copy. But on page 19, lines 19.5 to 19.15 is the only section of this bill that is within this committee's jurisdiction. So, Representative Sundin, welcome to the committee. Please briefly tell us what this bill is and what it briefly. And then we're going to ask you about the part within the jurisdiction of the committee. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 865 is a product stewardship bill. Deals with the recycling of batteries, carpet, and paint. It's been well vetted in other committees, and there's a general consensus that this committee should be looking at the subdivision that you described, and I have PCA experts with me, and plenty of expert testimony or testifiers in the audience. We could go on for hours if you want.
So, members, I just want to get a sense. Is there anyone in the audience who's going to testify against this bill at this point? Okay. So, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Please go ahead, but be very brief and try to stick to the part that's within the jurisdiction of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Garth Hickel. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Regarding the private enforcement section, this only applies to the primary batteries section of the bill. Primary batteries are A, AA, D cells, your typical batteries that are used in a whole variety of household products. The section was the subdivision was included at the request of the primary battery industry, so essentially Energizer, Duracell, and so forth, and it will essentially create a pathway for the stewardship organization that is expected to fulfill the manufacturer responsibility portions of the program operation to access the civil pursue civil action against manufacturers that are not complying with the statute. However, this will only occur if the agency is not actually undergoing compliance and enforcement actions, and the agency fully expects to do so in keeping with the other product stewardship programs that we do have in the state. The agency takes that level playing field responsibility very seriously.
Thank you. And members, it actually needs to go to Environment Finance next. I was mistaken. Representative Drazkowski.
Madam Chair, I just asked for a roll call on the bill.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski asked for a roll call on the bill. Are there questions from members? Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Last call. All right. The clerk will take the roll on House File 865, the third engrossment.
Hillstrom.
Aye.
Moline.
Aye.
Drazkowski.
No.
Bly.
Aye.
Cornish.
No.
Portman.
Aye.
Johnson B.
No.
Johnson S.
Yes.
Lesh.
Aye.
Lean.
Aye.
McNamer.
Aye.
O'Neill.
No.
Paymar.
Aye.
Pugh.
No.
Scott.
No.
With 10 in favor and 5 against, this bill passes. Thank you, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, we have just Representative Liebling's bill left. We're going to need to come back. Representative Lesh, your committee is meeting at 5:30? At 6? At 6. Members, would you like us to meet at 5:30? I don't know if we can do the bill in 30 minutes tonight, or if you'd like to do it after civil law. Depends on how much time you think you need for Representative Liebling's bill. I want to give you time to ask questions.
Before.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll be meeting at 5:30. This meeting is in recess. We're going to reconvene the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Liebling. Representative Liebling, the chair will move that House File 947 be recommended to pass. And does it need to go anywhere else, Representative Liebling, or just the General Register?
I'm not aware that it needs to go anywhere else, Madam Chair.
Okay. Then the chair moves House File 947 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for coming back to hear this, and I hope we won't take a lot of your time. This is a bill, if you look at the House Research Bill Summary, it really explains the background of this bill, and that is that we had a legislative auditor's report in March of 2011, and one of the recommendations included a recommendation to the commissioner to work with the reviser of statutes to separate the statutes relating to civil commitment of sex offenders and those relating to civil commitment of other populations. And so the bill before you is a response to that request. It is a purely technical bill. If there's anything in here that isn't purely technical, it's a mistake. This is supposed to separate those statutes, to simply make it easier for those who administer these statutes and those who are attempting to make changes in the future to these statutes to have a little cleaner playing field. And for practitioners, having these statutes melded together has made things a little bit confusing over time. So, as I say, it's a purely technical bill. I have with me today Robin Vu Benson, who's an attorney with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program,
Department
of Human Services, which manages that program, to talk about the details and answer questions. But members, that's all it is. It's a purely technical bill.
And members, the entire provision isn't really within the jurisdiction of the committee, I don't think. There are sections.
I mean, do you want to briefly go through it? And then if there's questions, we'll have members ask while we get information about specific sections that apply to this committee.
Yes, I can.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I am a Deputy General Counsel with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, in which the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is housed. As Representative Liebling indicated, the need for this was identified by the Legislative Auditor's Report in 2011, and the legislature enacted a provision in the end of the 2011 session directing the department to work with the Revisor's Office to separate the statutes and to clearly distinguish the sex offender-related civil commitment statutes from those that are related to other civil commitment populations. And the product of that work is before you in this bill. There are two resources that have been provided to members. One is an annotation of what was the first, was the DE1 amendment, which provides members with references for each of the changes that are made to existing language or changes that are made to carry this out, and explains what's happening with those changes. So the line numbering isn't exactly synced up with what is the current state of the bill. It's from the DE1, but it does have that level of detail about the certain changes. The other resource that's been provided to members is the handout that gives the background and summary and highlights of this bill, and identifies with particularity some of the items that fall in the category of clarification or distinguishing the sex offender civil commitment statutes from the general civil commitment statutes, such as the terminology for head of treatment facility versus executive director, patient versus committed person, designated agency versus county attorneys. Everything else is a matter of renumbering and moving things around, sometimes having to replicate things. So there does appear what looks like new language at times, but it's not new to the statute. It's new because we couldn't simply renumber it. We had to, as part of the separation, pull out or copy and paste in some cases. So in terms of the structure of the bill that's before you, there's really three chunks to it, if I could use that term in this setting. The first collection of sections, 1 through I believe it's 9, that takes existing language in 253B and prepares it for its move to the new chapter, 253D. It strikes language that doesn't need to stay in 253B, or provides added language that needs to go with the existing provision into 253D. The middle section of changes is where it appears to have a lot of new language or changes that may come off as new language. That is preparing sections that are going to be moved in whole to 253D for that movement. And then the last section, I think it's 22, with the directions to the Revisor's Office on renumbering, does the heavy lifting in the bill by moving sections into a new chapter and organizing them in a coherent way. There's also direction on construction of this so that it is not to be construed as making substantive changes or affecting the non-sex offender civil commitment population or categories of commitment. That's the overview. I can certainly welcome the opportunity to answer questions.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, any questions? All right, with that, the chair renews her motion that House File 947 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Thank you very
members,
much.
Members, we have two sets of minutes that we need to approve. So if I could get a motion to approve the minutes on March 14th. Representative Scott moves the minutes of March 14th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And then I need a motion on March 19th. Representative McNamer moves the minutes of March 19th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, with that,
we have completed our business that we know of between now and the break. We don't have another minute, another meeting until after the break. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
God bless America.